Hey, what's up? David Scales here, Surf Splendor. You know that Spy Optic was one of the first brands to support this podcast, right alongside Neat Essentials. I know that you probably only purchase sunglasses once a year or so, so maybe you've been on the fence since you've been hearing me talk about them. Well, summer is upon us here north of the equator, and we want to get you off the fence. We're juicing the deal. Use our promo code podcast on spyoptic.com in June, and we'll give you a free Spy t-shirt. Just add it to your cart, and our promo code will cancel out the cost. That code also will include a branded Surf Splendor custom sunglass pouch, and most importantly, for orders over $85, Spy is gifting you a one-year Surf Rider membership. That's three freebies, one of which has karmic points, and you'll love the sunglasses, of course, and become a lifelong convert to Spy, and of course, embark on a relationship with Surf Rider. So spyoptic.com, promo code podcast, see happy. Thanks. I've been to Hawaii in the winter twice. I've been 10 times total, but only twice in the winter. Seems like an unimportant distinction, numerating my visits by season. It also seems pompous to dismiss the 8 Hawaiian vacations because they were during the 3 quarters of the year where the Pacific Ocean swells bypass the North Shore. Those 8 trips were lovely. Time was spent with family, hills were hiked, banana bread was eaten, luau's attended. All 8 times I left tanned and fattened, but hollow. The Hawaii that had raptured my teenage attention and that had been indistinguishably tangled into my surf consciousness was still unexperienced. Regardless of where one discovers surfing, if they have any access to surf media of any kind, Hawaii is their siren. Hawaii is ubiquitous in surf media. And when any surfer references Hawaii, they are referring to the North Shore of Oahu between the months of November through February. Winter on the North Shore generates surf imagery that fills publications worldwide year-round, and often for decades beyond. The allure of surfers and non-surfers alike emanates from a delicate balance between terror and beauty. The ocean and the land offer moments of sublimity that can abruptly shift into horrendous consequence. Not tourists nor professional surfers are immune to the peril, and the stakes only intensify the seduction. The desire to witness the sublime is obvious, but the drive and willingness to surf the North Shore requires a strange brew of athleticism, bravado, and savvy. These figures are worth examination. Their shared requisite qualifications predisposes them to colorful backstories, harrowing tales of waves survived, and a nomadic existence. Their bodies show evidence of their near misses, and their faces convey their distinct feelings about your presence. As I've aged, and with 30 years of viewing surf imagery on the North Shore, the incidence of seeing fresh perspective of a loved wave has all but vanished. Inversely, my desire to better know the humans who brave those waves has compounded. Those souls and I share a desire to glide on the surface of the ocean, but their willingness to risk life in pursuit of a deeper, larger, more intense glide is where our desires diverge. I've spent the past few years on this podcast asking some of the people about their motivations. Did someone in their youth make them feel inferior? What justifications do they offer their kids for risking their lives? Do they believe in divine anointing that allows them impunity? Are they ever satisfied? I remember an image of Dustin Barco with a butterfly, the center of the composition, perched on his finger. His left profile is on the right side of the frame. He's nearly smiling, attentive in conversation. I had never seen this Barco. That said, the image also showcased his chiseled shoulder and cauliflowered ear, harbingers that this is, in fact, the MMA fighter and Monsanto combatant that the surf media usually portrays with a scowl and chipped tooth forward. The figure on the left side of the frame is literally mirrored in Barca's cyborg-styled Oakley sunglasses. He's the far less fit, far more fashionable, world-renowned American painter and filmmaker Julian Schnabel. Schnabel, in his smart frames with yellow-tinted lenses and button-down pajama top, looks to be regaling Barca. and the marvel, that is the butterfly, daintily resting atop Barca's pointed finger, seems unacknowledged by the two, as if all one has to do to convene with a butterfly in Hawaii is outstretch a finger. The image gave me completely fresh insights and left me with questions, different questions than I had ever asked about Hawaii. The image epitomized what I was unaware was missing from my Southern California exposure to the Hawaii winter. It showcased the dichotomy of strength and grace that I was accustomed to from decades of surf imagery, but it also revealed a level of humanity that had somehow evaded nearly all the imagery that filled my youth. I began following Justin Jay's work and was pleased to find that this human interest themed imagery was not a detour in his photography, but in fact the focus. I reveled in the scarce images that he published, some on his social media and website, and far too occasionally to Transworld Surf, Stab, and Beach Grit. I eventually reached out to Justin and we met for coffee in his hometown of Carpinteria, California in March of 2015. That conversation was recorded and published as episode 78 of Surf Splendor. Justin explained that he travels from New York each winter to spend a couple of weeks in Hawaii. And while that explained the images that I had seen, I asked him why I hadn't seen even more images. 2 weeks in Hawaii every year is enough time to garner hundreds, if not thousands, of images, and yet I could only find a few dozen. Justin was vague in his response, and in lieu of a definitive answer, I abandoned my curiosity and just accepted the reality that he's modest and reserved. I rationalized that he's probably not much of a self-promoter, and that he's a meticulous curator of the torrent of images that he captures, and that's why he's only shared a rare few. Regardless, I've been left with an unsated lust for Justin's work. In the subsequent years since our meeting in the spring of 2015, print publications have further constricted, and I've been relegated to viewing nearly all of Justin's work through the blue light emanating from my computer, or worse, as a 2-inch by 2-inch square in my Instagram feed. But then, in September of 2018, Justin emailed to finally address my inquiry. He revealed that 10 years worth of archived photos would not only be shared, but would actually be printed on real paper and bound into an actual book. I felt a surge of nostalgia for unseen images that I had hastily reconciled as unworthy, for a revival in print in an ambitious fashion, and most acutely, for a longing to know the demigods who spend their winters challenging the North Shore. When I got in like at 9:45 last night, I was supposed to get in an hour earlier, but I decided to stop in New Haven, Connecticut for pizza because I've heard that is the new pizza mecca. Are you familiar with this?
I'm not.
Okay. Are you a pizza aficionado?
You know what? I'm going to say no. Okay. I'm with a caveat. I feel like pizza, I feel like there's the 80% formula with pizza. And I think it's like with sushi too. I feel like 80% of pizza is within this bell curve of like, yeah, it's pretty good. Pizza, it's dough, it's cheese, water. 10% is garbage, and 10% is like amazing. And like, I'm a fan of amazing pizza, but like, I'm not the like, I need my New York slice twice a week kind of guy.
Interesting.
So that's my take.
Just in the last few minutes that we've been hanging out, you have analogies for everything, and they're really enlightening.
Thank you.
That's an excellent analogy. There is the 80% bell curve thing. What is that? Maybe this is where you're pulling it from. Isn't there like a scientist who studied pea pods and figured out something like the 80-20?
Oh, I don't know. Okay. Maybe I'm like, maybe I'm osmosisly brilliant okay. about something that I'm not even aware. Well, it's actually written, it's funny, I have a barber down the block, and I feel like there's like kind of the similar thing with people too. I feel like 80% of the people are just kind of like, yeah, they're people. And 10% are like particularly hot, and 10% are like particularly ugly. And there's kind of the running joke, like my man Zach, he's great, I love him, but his dad also works in the barbershop, and like we refer to him affectionately as Zach is the son of the ugliest man in the Lower East Side. Like, amazing. He's really particularly not good looking.
So, amazing. Yeah, with pizza though, I feel like the 80% has shifted towards the good. Like, I agree that 80% was always at play, but when I was a kid, the 80% was on, it was all just kind of a lower quality. Now,
like Friday pizza day in the cafeteria.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And now I feel like across the board, pizza's better than it was when I was a kid. And that's why I wanted to ask you about it, being in, obviously New York City's known for pizza. I was in Boston, they have like a whole pizza thing there. And then everybody's telling me New Haven, Connecticut. So on the drive down, I just swung through and stopped. And it's like, you know what? It's very good. But Boston was very good. New York is very good. Back in California, we have very good options.
I feel like it's the same thing with coffee. Like, why is it that like coffee only became good in the last decade or whatever? It's not that deep, people. It's beans and water. Like, every coffee should be good, you know?
When we were kids, you couldn't find a good cup of coffee. Yeah. Like, based on our standards of what we would deem as good, it was undrinkable when I was a kid. It was mostly Folgers, like freeze-dried, you know?
I feel like California is a little ahead of the curve, though, in New York. Like, you can get good coffee here, but, like, your base-level coffee is still, like, your deli coffee. Not that great. California, like, you go to a gas station or Denny's, and you'll be like, damn, this is a tasty cup of tea. You feel like Harvey Keitel in Pulp Fiction.
It's so true. I stopped at the bagel place right down the street, Kozar. Is that what it is?
Yeah, Kozar. It's been there for, 100 years or something.
And the coffee was super mediocre.
Yeah,
I assumed it would be good because it's like good bagels. They have to have good coffee. No,
you know, it's fine. I thought New York would be a good sandwich town too. It's not, you know, like you get the like quote unquote deli sandwich, which is like, you know, half a pound of pastrami on like a little pizza. Like, that's amazing. We kind of own that. But just like California, like they're like sourdough with some like lettuce and tomato and some like homemade roast beef. Like, you don't really get that here. Yeah. You know.
So where were you from before New York?
Basically, Carpinteria, where we did our last podcast. So I moved literally from my parents' garage to New York City, and originally for 6 months, and now it's been 20 plus years. I just kind of fell in love with Manhattan, never left.
Why were you going to move for the 6 months?
There was a little bit of boredom, and a girl was involved, and and a pretty traditional story.
Yeah, but,
I think what I love most about New York is there's this element of kind of happenstance and serendipity that you don't see in a lot of other places. I had loved photography growing up as a kid and took it as an elective in high school, but never really set out to be a photographer per se, and just kind of the world conspired and circumstances and people you meet, and you kind of just like, I fell into this, and here I am. And I think that's what makes New York City so special. You don't necessarily get that in a lot of places. If you really wanted to do career X in whatever city you live in, if you really focus, you maybe probably could pull that off, but it probably won't happen by accident. And you get a lot of that in New York City. So
what job were you going to do when you moved out here for the 6 months?
I
restaurant job?
Yeah, I mean, random? I worked in restaurants for 10 plus years. Like, started, bussing tables in Santa Barbara, and then, I worked and got fired and changed restaurants and did the whole restaurant thing here. And actually, it's funny. I used to have a big storefront space that I had in the East Village, like pretty much all through the 90s. And it was like an old converted storefront with like an illegal loft space. And there was 4 bedrooms. And 2 of my roommates were photo assistants at the time. And I just graduated from school, and I was waiting tables. And it basically came down to like, the day rate back then for a photo assistant was, whatever, $150, whatever it was. And that's basically what they were making as photo assistants, what I was making, like serving pasta to jerks at restaurants. And I was like, kind of really got into that as an alternative to waiting tables, and kind of grew from there.
That's awesome. I know we covered a lot of your origin story in that past podcast, so in the intro to this, I'll refer people back to that to catch that, so we're not playing too much catch up. But there are a couple of stories that are worth revisiting. Let's start with what is the business model currently for a photographer living in New York? What, for you specifically, what does it look like?
It's hard. I mean, I am able to kind of pull it off because I have, you know, some existing clients, and I thankfully have like a, you know, great wife who has a great career, and we kind of split bills in that way, and was fortunate enough to buy my apartment, you know, 10 years ago. So to some degree, those expenses are locked in. So, I mean, all these little factors help in play. But honestly, I at this point, I don't really know what the business model is moving forward. I mean, I have a 3-year-old son. I definitely want him to be creative. But like, once you go to business school, dude, like, yeah. I honestly, it's hard, you know, because I feel like the model for photography used to be this really unique combination of skill and trade mixed with art. And I think with the technology of today, it's kind of becoming less and less of neither, you know, because anybody can do it to a degree, but at the same time, there's just this massive dissemination of like white noise of imagery. And so I think the art's gotten a little bit kind of rounded on the edges as well. And it's just a lot harder. I mean, I think the writing's on the wall, that the still image is not really the wave of the future, you know. I mean, for me personally as a photographer, you know, it's sad. I think if you're a teenager with your first iPhone, it's an amazing time for photography, you know, but I kind of feel like I'm a, you know, a typesetter and like all of a sudden, like the digital revolution is coming, you know. I think the writing's on the wall that this is not the wave of the future.
What about, you said you have a list of clients.
I mean,
they still need work,
they
right?
Do.
Are rates going down because of all those other things, or?
I feel like there's still, I think just, it's kind of a metaphor for the nation as a whole. I feel like the middle class of photography is kind of getting squeezed. I mean, there's still 30 guys that are making a fortune. I mean, there's still a need for very high-end stuff. I've been a little bit fortunate because to a degree, some of my lane is celebrity-based, and there's a firewall there of, you know, publicists and access that not anybody can do, as opposed to, I mean, I don't really shoot any action photography per se, like on the North Shore, but I mean, if you look at like surf, quote unquote, surf photography, like that market's just completely bottomed out because, you know, everybody with a GoPro or like a camera or a $200 waterproof camera can kind of do the same stuff that the legends did 20 years ago, you know, and magazines are basically getting free content, and they're certainly not paying what they used to, you know. So it's sad in a way, but it's, you know, it's change. You got to adapt just like anything else.
I don't want to shame any pro surf photographers, some of whom are my friends or your friends or whatever, because you can't really pin this on just one person, but I wonder how much of that bottoming out is their own fault. And I see this with the surf business as a whole. Like, board builders do this, writers do this, where they essentially work for free. You know, it's like they might be super talented and they have a lot of expense wrapped up in this thing, but they just want to be friends with the industry. They want to be friends with magazines or the pro surfers or whatever. And a great way to get in is to show up and work harder than anybody else for free. But then they never learn to make that transition to actually charge for their work.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's entirely true. And part of the problem with that statement is that I don't think there is that transition. Like, once, you know, pretty much the first rate that you charge for a client, it's kind of sets you in for, you know, whether it's free or $100 or $1,000, it's rare that, it's not like at a traditional job where you get a promotion and you get a raise. Like, it's pretty much your kind of, that's your rate. And so if you come out of the gate saying, oh, I'll give you free content, like, they're never going to be like, oh, I loved your last free content, here's $1,000 instead. Right. You know, it's a kind of the race to the bottom. But I mean, I can't point too many fingers at those people, or even, you know, I've been guilty of that myself. And that's kind of the curse of doing what you love and trying to make a career out of it, is like, you know, no one's gonna babysit or like fix a car for free because that's what you get paid to do that. But like, if you're getting paid to travel around the world and like take pictures of surfing when you have a love of surfing, it's kind of easier to be like, well, okay, you know, at least I'm getting to do what I want to do. Yeah. You know, so.
But it keeps the industry cottage in a way that I don't think is beneficial for everybody. Like, you could have people making a living and a sustainable living, raising kids, sending them to college, and then building the industry larger, you know, that we would all benefit from. I'm not saying large is just good, but those people end up, once they become, you know, skilled photographers, they take jobs outside of the surfing industry. And then eventually you talk to them 5 years, 10 years later, and you realize they're really not shooting surfing at all anymore, because there was, so it'd be amazing if you could make surfing profitable, which we can.
Yeah.
It's just that cottage thing is true in all aspects of the sport, you know?
I mean, I think it's, there's been a little bit of slump, not just in the philosophy of what people are charging, but also just like the dollars and cents coming in out of the industry. I mean, with everything you've been talking about on the podcast, you know, extensively in the last 6 months, I think with the Olympics and wave pools, and I mean, there's definitely some new avenues for revenue to kind of be streaming into the surf industry, like how that's all going to play out and whether that's going to translate into this, you know, second coming for surf photography. But I don't know. That's, you know, TBD, but
I think that's where it's incumbent upon guys like you and I and whoever else to now recognize, look, we're at a precipice where this could blow up. Thanks to Kelly with the wave pools and like whatever else. And now we need to charge appropriately. So when ESPN or some kind of fringe surf media comes in asking for work, figure out what do football photographers charge, or whatever else they're used. Because ESPN's used to paying those rates and then charge that.
True. You know? I mean, I think I guess the key to that is getting those large, you know, behemoth industries to come in and start being a part of the industry, as opposed to trying to get, you know, Volcom to raise your rates, because that's not going to happen.
Right, you know? Right, right. Well, you said that part of your lane is celebrity. How did you get into that lane?
It kind of grew, I guess ultimately one of my first, you know, big breaks, if you will, is I used to work as a personal photographer to Sean Combs for 10 years on and off. And so cross paths with, you know, all sorts of people, mostly in the music industry. I mean, and that was like another side note of another industry that's had dramatic changes in the last 10 years, you know, but basically before the music business went out of business, I used to shoot a lot of hip hop stuff, and I traveled, did tour projects with Outkast and with the Strokes, and kind of, I think once you get some celebrity stuff in your book, you either A, have access to those people and build relationships, or B, a lot of the gatekeepers for celebrity stuff tend to be not necessarily creatives, but publicists. And it's an interesting dynamic because they're kind of just looking for the safest picture that's going to save their job, as opposed to like an art director who wants to like shoot for the moon and make amazing, you know, iconic imagery. So if you have a book filled with, not to say that my stuff is just average, but if you have just, you know, average pictures of lots of different celebrities, that actually kind of bodes better for you than having like amazing pictures of your next door neighbor, you know? And so there's definitely like a little bit of a kind of political access to that kind of stuff. And, you know, once you shoot a few covers, you kind of like get into that world and you have a little bit of a body to fall back on, and it kind of tends to snowball a little bit.
I would love to hear more about your time with Sean Combs.
It was a lot of time I spent with him. I got traveled overseas with him a lot, and I got to meet a lot of just absolutely incredible people. I guess the long and short of it is a lot of respect for that guy. You know, everybody has an opinion about him, but for better or worse, he's completely self-made. There's no, you know, puppet master behind him. He is a beast, and he works hard, and he's incredibly smart, and he's incredibly charismatic. And I think what people kind of know and recognize him for is him being an artist, you know, a rapper. And I think that kind of happened almost accidentally for him, you know, like after Biggie passed away, and he, you know, had the hit song with the Sting sample, and, you know, blah, blah, everyone knows that story. But he, you know, he really knows his lane in terms of, like, he has a massive amount of respect for, you know, Jay-Z and people that are, I think, probably more talented at that. But I think his major talent, and he's just, you know, kind of one of a kind of that, he's just like, he's just a great leader, you know, and whether that's as a producer or as a business you know, executive, he just, everybody in his sphere just wants, like, you want to follow him into battle because you feel like he knows something that you don't, and you want to be a part of it. And it's just, he's a great team leader, really smart guy.
Fascinating. Have you maintained any contact with him in recent years?
I have. I talked to him, unfortunately, this is actually a very sad story. His girlfriend and mother of his three children just passed away unexpectedly about 2 weeks ago. This is really, really sad. And so I was actually going through some of the archives, just picking out some images to send them for the memorial. And just really, it's interesting just having these just incredibly intimate pictures of people that you don't necessarily keep in contact anymore. Like, I was there at the hospital the day Kim's twin baby girls were born, and I've known Christian, his son, since he's like 1 year old. And, you know, now he's an Instagram star and he's a rapper or whatever. But, you know, it's really interesting just to see the transformation and have these really incredibly intimate moments that I captured. Like, I saw this one picture, it kind of took my breath away. It was a picture of Puffy and Kim surprising Puff's mom and letting her know that they were pregnant, and they had a picture of the sonogram of the twin baby girls, and it was like a picture of like Puff and his mom and Kim and a sonogram with the twin girls. And, you know, those girls are now 10 years old and Kim just passed away. Like, it's just, it's really, it's kind of cool to have those moments memorialized for other people. You know, I think even on the North Shore, that's what I strive to do. What makes me the happiest is when I'm able to just kind of capture these moments that will just be gone in the ether and never be visited again, and then just have them kind of memorialized for the benefit of that person. You know, it means a lot to me.
I saw the photo you posted of Kim on Instagram when she passed away, and yeah, it made me view your work in a different light. Not better or worse, but like a more kind of serious light or sincere or something, where I was like, oh shoot, like this now becomes real that this person has passed away, and you having access into their life. Like, first of all, it takes a lot of trust for them to even allow a photographer in, but then do they require to see everything before you ever publish it or share it, or are those photos strictly for them, for their own usage?
It all depends. Like that sitting in particular, like, I happened to be at the hospital the day that the twins were born just because of my relationship with Puff, and I wanted to be there, and, you know, he wanted it memorialized. And then it was right at the peak of when you know, like J-Lo and Gwen Stefani and all these people were doing these huge photo shoots to sell to People magazine or whatever, and you know, Puff has kind of had a lot of heat right at that point, and people were interested in him, and we basically were like, people are gonna be standing in the bushes trying to get pictures of these kids anyway, like, why don't you make some money at it instead? And I had a relationship at Getty at the time, so I pitched this project, and so we did that shoot specifically with the intent of syndicating it, and I got a piece of that. So that was, everything was, you know, pre-approved, and that was specifically, you know, for public consumption. Some of the other stuff, in general, my whole access to him had always been predicated on the trust that I wouldn't really put anything out that he wasn't comfortable with, and I have never really broken that trust. The irony is that it was such a strange time to be documenting, because it was really pre-social media, and it's almost like the whole mindset and philosophy is switched. I mean, I have like amazing shots of him, like with Johnny Cochran and Ben Brofman, his lawyers, like the night before he was going to testify for his weapons trial. And there's like a picture of the New York Post on their desk with him on the cover. Like, you know, these crazy iconic photos that kind of just never really been seen. And they're sitting in a box, you know, because of that trust issue. And then you cut to today, and like every celebrity, him included, is like doing selfies on the toilet and narrating their life. And it's like the whole philosophy of privacy is almost completely flipped. So it was a strange time to document him like that, because almost a massive majority of those photos have really never been seen, you know?
But as a testament to the art of photography, like the images that you're talking about are so much more powerful and impactful than the selfie that he's shooting on the toilet. You know what I mean?
No, true. And it's interesting to see how that plays out. I mean, I would like to think that at some point there is going to be an appetite for those photos. And I think they'll maintain or maybe even grow in their significance, because, mm-hmm. you know, when I first started working with Sean, I, you know, pretty much said to him, I was like, I really don't have any interest of taking pictures of you drinking champagne in a club. That's what everyone thinks you do. That's what they've seen in the videos. It's not, you know, it's not what I'm interested in. And, you know, he was really on the same page with me. And, like, my favorite photos are literally, like, him with his children. Or, you know, I just try to put myself in the perspective of being, like, a 12-year-old fan, whether it's, like, surf or music or whatever. Like, I want to see, like, what does Mick Jagger's backstage look like, you know? Or what do the Sex Pistols look like when they're on their bus? Or, you know, like, what does Puffy's closet look like, you know? And that's what I've tried to capture. And I think those moments, just because they're kind of personal and have a historical element, like, hopefully they'll maintain or grow in their value.
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role, and there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than a billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's linkedinjobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah, I think they will. You're right. It is interesting to see how this all shakes out, because you've heard me say probably on the podcast that it's like I've gotten to know Kelly Slater better through Instagram than I ever did through the magazines growing up. So his curated thing was enough to get me interested in him, like his curated image through professional photography in the magazine. But then his Instagram, like being able to see, like I said, what the floor of his car looks like when the camera's swinging around, or his home or whatever, that makes me connect with him in a new way. But there's a higher art. Moving forward, there might be two lanes. There's kind of just like the trashy reality TV version of someone's life, which is Instagram. And then there is kind of a respectful art curated version of their life, which could be the portrait photography or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean. I don't want to, you know, place any, you know, value assessment of how good or bad, you know, my approach to artistically taking those photos are. But if nothing else, just the whole Instagram generation, in one sense, you're getting this very intimate look at a person's life, but it's through the prism of their eyes. Totally. And that's a key difference. And then sometimes if you watch a documentary on someone's life, the difference between people who make documentaries about themselves versus mm-hmm. people who, when you have an outside person with a vision and perspective of trying to tell a story, you're going to tell a much different story than if that person's telling it themselves. So.
I agree. You were talking about your approach with Sean Combs with photography. What's your approach when you go to Hawaii? You're going next week, is it, or Saturday?
I'm going on Saturday. Yeah. I mean, ironically, I feel like there's a lot of similarities between the skill set of shooting, you know, my world and the hip hop and shooting on the North Shore, in the sense that I try and kind of take a week's worth of time or a day's worth of time and distill it into a couple key figures, you know, key elements that kind of represent larger than that. And then there's also a degree of sociology involved and psychology. And like, I pretty much, you go into the North Shore and it's like that, it's the same thing as walking into a room with a celebrity or walking into the, you know, Volcom house. It's like you have to show respect, make your presence known, you know, whether that's shaking someone's hand and being respectful, or sometimes it's just eye contact. Like, I know you're here, you know I'm here, like, I'm cool. And then just like back away and let them forget about you. And learning how to do that it can be a hard skill, but it's super valuable. And so a lot of the same skill sets that I learned traveling with hip hop artists, like, apply very aptly to shooting on the North Shore. Yeah.
What exactly does the trip look like for you? Do you have contacts lined up in advance and appointments set up, or people that you're going to be staying with? Are there any brands that are expecting any work out of you?
You know, this year in particular, and I don't know if this speaks to the industry or what, like I'm really don't have much going on this year, kind of in a good way. Like I have a place to stay, I have my nuts and bolts all settled, but I don't really have any concrete plans or shoots lined up, and I'm kind of just gonna, this might just be a swan song for me going over there. I'm not sure how many more years I'm gonna be going. It's kind of like I'm wrapping up this 10-year book project, and so we'll see. I mean, who knows? I thought after 5 years I pretty much said the same thing, so talk to me in another 10, maybe I'll still keep going every year. But I think this year I'm just gonna really soak it in, try and take a few pictures, and really like just kind of do a little victory lap of like all the amazing memories that I've been able to kind of have on the North Shore.
Are you saying that because you are done with the North Shore? Like you've kind of done what you need to do there and you just feel ready to move on?
A little bit of that. I mean, which isn't to be reductive that like, oh, I've captured it
and
now that there's nothing else to view. It's just that I think I got really lucky when I started this book and having documented this 10-year decade, this 10 years of on the North Shore. There's just been so many change. People have passed away. The industry's changed a lot. The culture has changed a lot. The nationalities of the top five athletes have changed a lot. It's been a real transformative time. You know, the vibe over there has changed a lot. And I think it's kind of a nice bookend to kind of put to the end of this era in terms of me personally documenting it. I mean, the same love that brought me over there to want to shoot it in the first place, I definitely still have that. And, you know, moving forward, I don't know what that looks like. Maybe next year I'll go with my wife and son and we'll just make a kind of family vacation and get to experience the surf circus during the Pipe Masters from a different perspective. But, you know, in terms of me, like, just begging and borrowing and stealing and trying to make time and trying to find client, it's just like it's a real struggle. And so I don't know, you know, I just kind of want to put a bow on this project and then see where it leads me from there.
Tell me about that very first trip to Hawaii.
It was exciting. I mean, I was definitely flying without a net on that one.
Really?
Well, originally it had started as a editorial project for a magazine, and I'd always wanted to, you know, shoot the North Shore. I'd been to Hawaii as a kid, but I'd never really, you know, been in a surf sphere to the North Shore. And I wanted to just kind of document it in a way that I'd never really seen before, you know, like, and I definitely wanted those pictures to be shown in a magazine. I didn't want to do the project for an action sports magazine. I wanted to bring it to, you know, a different audience. And so I had a magazine lined up, and this was in the fall of 2008, like right when the world was about to end, and basically just the magazine folded one morning, and so the project was just dead. And so I was like, you know what, I'm gonna go do this anyway. And I pretty much had two contacts. I had Troy Eckert at Volcom had been really great to me and said he would introduce me to some people, and Pat O'Connell had been a terrific ambassador. And so pretty much those are literally the only two people that I knew, and kind of landed on the North Shore and stayed at this weird hotel in Laie that's not even there anymore, and realized it was like, you know, I thought it was like a 5-minute drive. It was like a 40-minute drive. Yeah. Like it's far, you know, like whatever, you live and learn. But it was an interesting first trip, you know, and just kind of leveraging those relationships and like leads to meeting to this person. And, you know, 10 years later, I'm still like inspired by that place.
Were there any iconic images in your, not iconic to the world, but maybe just for yourself that like really served as optimistic and gave you, you know?
Yeah, I feel like, I think looking back on those images, I think I really hit my stride on that project like 2-3 years in. I mean, yeah. That first year, me personally, I was inspired just because I was like, oh my God, I just like hung out with Rob Machado and Pat O'Connell for the day. I was more kind of like, you know, surf starstruck, if nothing else. But looking back at the photos, they're not really as like evocative as some of the later stuff. But I mean, I had some funny, like for instance, I think my first or second day there, I met Pat O'Connell, was at his house, and he's like, oh yeah, we're going to dinner tonight if you want to, you know, come meet me. It's at this place called Haleiwa Joe's. And I was like, okay, well, is it on the map? I mean, it's so fresh that I knew nothing, right? And so I was hanging out with basically Pat and Blair Marlin, who's like a, you know, he's in sports management, and they're both super nice, really nice to me. And so I roll up to the parking lot, Holly Eva Joe's, and Blair had his head shaved at the time. And so I see this figure like about to walk into Holly Eva Joe's. I'm like, oh my God, I actually ran into someone I know. So I run up and I give him a big pat on the back. I'm like, hey, good to see. And I turn around and it's Kelly Slater.
No way.
Yeah. So my first day there, I just like basically, you know, back slapped Kelly Slater, and he kind of turned around and was like, do I know you? And then, of course, he ends up, we're all sitting at the same table. So okay. It was very awkward, and but funny. And he was cool about it. But it was just like, it's like a real metaphor for like my first day on the North Shore. It was a full Howley move.
That know? Is so, so funny, yeah. Dude. You talked about, well, you've kind of referenced this book a number of times. Tell me about the book. What is the book? 10 Years on the North Shore is the concept?
The title of the book is it's H-I-1-K, and it's basically 10 years, 1,000 moments on the North Shore. And so it's going to have a lot of pictures, a lot of personal captions from me. And last year I did about 15 to 20 interviews with people just kind of asking them what the North Shore means, how's the North Shore changed, why is the North Shore special, why is it still relevant, and it's pretty fortunate to be able to get, you know, pretty broad range of answers from a broad range of people from Eddie Rothman to Shane Dorian. Kelly I didn't get, but I'm gonna get that this year for sure. But so yeah, it'll have quotes, it'll have captions, and a lot of photos, and we're working on somebody really special to get a forward to write some stuff right now. So
sweet,
yeah.
So does it have 1,000 pictures, 1,000 images in it?
We're still in the design page okay. Right now. We have some space limitations in terms of paper budget.
Yeah.
I originally really was trying to make it 1,000 images. I think we might kind of play on the 1,000 moments a little bit more. It's still TBD. I mean, I wanted it to have a lot of images just because each of the images kind of might mean something different to different people. And I just wanted to feel like a combination of a scrapbook / yearbook / kind of tribute to a moment in time on the North Shore. And, and it's really a reflection of not just who is important per se, but it's also really just a personal reflection of like who I've been fortunate enough to cross paths with, which for the most part has been, you know, pretty exhaustive. Been really fortunate to get a lot of people in this book. Some of them I don't know, you know, but I've been able to still snag a really intimate moment or an intimate photo of them. So I really want to just have it include as many people as possible, from, you know, CT guys to like local people to photographers to, you know, just everybody that's really part of that culture in the winter.
The most cliche, you know, line ever is just like a picture paints 1,000 words. But I really do feel like with a lot of the images I've seen of yours, there's a story behind it. It's like I see it, like the success of your portrait photography is that it captures a story in an image. And so I was almost hoping that this book includes your story about where that image came from.
It'll have okay. That's one of the issues we're having right now is trying to like cull down my captions, just because I think it's really important. Some of the photos kind of speak for themselves, but some of them are an interesting photo, maybe not graphically the most, you know, iconic photo, but it coupled with the story behind it, it just adds a whole new layer and element to it. And so there's definitely a lot of like kind of personal input and captions that I'll be adding to the stuff.
Yeah. The adding the layer thing is smart. Like, because as I went through those thoughts, I was like, well, you could almost distract from the photo by giving information. It's better just to leave it in my imagination. But if you can add a layer, then that would be good.
And that's one of the conversations we had with the designers is whether we're going to have a legend in the back of like number 1, 2, 3 for, you'd be like, oh, who is that? And then you look in the back, and I think we decided, you know, practically speaking, it was too much of an undertaking, but also it just kind of, it adds a little element of like mystery to it. It's like people that know, if you know who it is, you know who it is. Otherwise, it's just kind of like, it's just a piece of this puzzle that adds to the mystery of this book, you know.
Yeah,
so but we'll see. But I mean, I've been meeting with a lot of people and seeking advice and trying to make sure that this is as strong as project as possible. And Glenn Friedman's like a friend of mine, an amazing photographer. He I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he shot pretty much the Dogtown and Z Boys, like that whole culture, and then bled into hip hop, and he's had a string of amazing books. And so I met with him and I showed him some of the photos and talked to the concept, and his advice was, you know, he gave great sage advice, just saying that it's your words are going to make these pictures come alive.
Okay.
You know, so he
take his advice then.
Yeah. He was definitely, he was like, it's add your captions, you know, even if whether it's two sentences or 600 words, like bring those pictures to life, you know?
You're good with words too, so that's good. Who is Indoic, and that's who you're partnering with?
Yeah, Indoic. They are originally introduced to them. They put out a really amazing book last year called Surf Shacks, and I have a bungalow out in Rockaway that I share with some friends, and they included our surf shack in their book, and we're in pretty esteemed company, you know, in the book. Like there's like Cassia Metter and then Mikey DeTemple and like the whole Point Dune gang. It's kind of ironic. Like, I think our quote-unquote shack is really the only shack in the book. Like, the other ones are these, like, amazing, like, Malibu beach homes. Yeah, and this, yeah, like, incredibly, like, post of the incredibly, you know, modern, appointed Montauk surf house or whatever. But, so, yeah, so I got introduced to those guys, and this is going to be their first input, the imprint. They actually designed that book but did not publish it. It was a German publisher. So our book, HI1K, is going to be their first imprint, and so we're putting it out together. Wow. So it'll be a lot of fun.
And who are they? I mean, they're doing more than just books, obviously.
Yeah, they. In terms of the brand, they, Matt and Ron, they have a design shop in Venice. So, I mean, they work with all sorts of clients from local businesses to Toyota. I mean, so they do a lot of like true design work outside of the surf world. And then Indoic is kind of like their, you know, pet brand that they've done some really amazing stuff. Like they did, a soft cover magazine / zine about Venice last year. And then they just did one on St. Augustine that came out, and it's like, I mean, it's fantastic. It's you know, tabloid size and like maybe 40, 50 pages. And it's just like beautiful photography. And, you know, just they do great design work, great content, and just super, super stoked to get to work with those guys. Cause I definitely needed another element in terms of, like, I think I have a pretty good eye as a photographer, but design wise, like, you know, I'm average. I'm not going to design my own book. And so to have, you know, a team together of people that just do like phenomenal design work, it makes me much more confident in this project.
I was so glad to see that you partnered with them, because kind of growing up in Orange County, where there is the surf industrial complex, that's all I'm focused on. I was focused on as a kid. And then occasionally I'll see something come in out of left field that wasn't really born in that industrial complex. And it might leave an imprint, it might not. With them, it's kind of like I saw something. I was like, oh, that's really good quality. Whatever it was that I saw was awesome. It might have been the Surf Shack series before they made the book.
Yeah, it was an internet. Basically, they created all the content for their website originally.
Right.
And then I think they must have got a book deal. And then the publisher let them to actually design the book as well.
Got it. So I saw a few of those and I was like, oh, that's high quality. And then, but I'm already focused on these things over here, so I ignore it. And then a few months later, another one comes through and I go, oh, that's really good quality. And then over a course of a year or two, I was like, who are these people? They're killing it. Like, they're getting killer interviews with interesting people, really great content. And then the design thing was always something that stood out for me too. And then I got that Surf Shack's book, I think for Christmas last year, maybe. Loved it. And then sure enough, like I said, I was psyched to see that you're the next one on the list.
So yeah, I'm really excited. It'll be a little different, experience, because that's with, like I said, with a German publisher, and they have pretty broad-based distribution. They do a lot of interior design books. We're probably at this point going to be selling most of our stuff either through online channels or book signings or through Indoic's, you know, website or my web presence. So it'll be a little bit more intimate in that sense, and we're going to keep the print run relatively small. Like I want to sell out. And if it sells out and there's still demand for more, like, that's terrific. We can discuss maybe a second printing, whatever. But I don't want to be the guy selling, like, mixtapes out of his trunk for the next 5 years.
I think that you could kind of gauge what your guys' you know, social influence is and kind of base numbers on that. I think you can do it pretty
accurately. So we're going to launch a pre-sales site. probably in the next couple weeks. And we'll have, that'll give us a pretty good indication of where we stand in, in terms of demand. You know, there's a mark that we have to make in terms of dollar amounts, and hopefully we'll, you know, come close to that. If it's 10% of that after 3 weeks, then, you know, we'll have to reconsider. But I mean, the upside is that I think for something like this, there'll be a lot of back-end revenue that we can get off the book. Like, we're intentionally not having any underwriters for the book because we didn't want any logo or anything other than, you know, my name and Doic's brand. But, you know, I didn't want, like, sponsored by Red Bull splashed all over the back, just because we kind of figured, you know, 6 months or 6 years from now, like, where the money came from to publish this book is going to be superfluous, but, like, that brand is going to be attached to us, like, forever, essentially. But on the tail side, we're going to do like a book tour and book signings. Perfect. And there's a lot of opportunities for branding and revenue on that end.
Good, good. Let's talk about some of the technical minutia. What do you shoot on, and have you kind of been shooting on the same equipment throughout the 10 years?
I really have. I like to keep it really simple. I grew up, when I first got into the, you know, professional photography industry, quote unquote, it was mostly as a photo assistant. And I kind of get intimidated by just so much equipment, and it takes so much just people and gaffers and you know, and I learned all that stuff, and I shot a lot in the studio. And then when I went to the North Shore, I mean, really more just financially, I didn't have a budget to operate on that level. But I found just throughout my career, like whether it's traveling, you know, with Puffy or Outkast or different bands, and it's just like it changes the dynamic, you know, like even, you know, when you came here this morning to set up your computer, and it's like we want to just like kind of start the conversation right away, but you know, you have to take a breather and set stuff up. And I kind of feel in that same way, that the times when I've like, okay, so I'm going to set up this light and we're going to do that, then it just becomes like quote unquote a photo shoot rather than me like just having like a authentic moment with this person. So pretty much when I shoot on the North Shore, I'm completely self-sufficient. I have one backpack, usually, you know, one body, my favorite lens. I have a prime 35 lens. It's like my favorite kind of storytelling lens. It's like not too wide to look wide, but it's not telephoto. You gotta kind of get in close and get the story. So it's, I'm definitely not lurking in bushes and, you know, doing kind of paparazzi stuff. And then if I'm shooting like a proper actual, you know, portrait, I'll use a little longer lens. But nuts and bolts wise, there's no magic formula. It's really simple stuff.
What body are you using?
I have like a Nikon D810, which is what I've been using. It's funny, it's kind of gone full circle. I grew up shooting Nikon film cameras, and when the digital revolution first happened, Nikon kind of dropped the ball. Like, they were kind of late to market in terms of developing like a really good sensor, and so I switched to Canon, and I don't know, I'm back to Nikon.
Cool. All your photos have a certain color palette. How much of that is done just through the equipment you're shooting on versus in post?
Most of it's, I think it's a combination of the unique lighting in Hawaii on the North Shore and in post. I mean, I like to characterize my post is very specific, but not too overdone. Like, I don't do a ton of stuff, and I definitely don't retouch in terms of, you know, moving faces or using multiple plates, or I usually don't really even take out, you know, blemishes or stuff like that, but it's mostly just for color. I have a kind of very specific vision for a color pass that I like to use for that project. But other than that, I like to keep it pretty natural.
What is your vision for that? I mean, how would you describe it, or what feel are you trying to achieve?
I just like to make it just like kind of, I want to make it feel like a Polaroid from the 70s. Like, it has like a very like soft pastel tone to it. There's a lot of cyan, a lot of cyan in the shadows, and there's a little bit of like kind of mustard yellow in the highlights, and I play with that and work with crushing some of the blacks, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, it is subtle, but it's almost it's a branding, you know. It's like you see a surfboard with that black strip down the center of it, and you're like, oh, that's a Slater's design. That's kind of how it is.
No, that's good. I'm glad it shines through. I mean, I don't do the same thing for every project, you know, I just, on a separate note, I was kind of angered. Like, I shot a cover story last summer of Lauren Bush, and she is actually the granddaughter of HW, just passed away, but she's married to David Lauren, who's the son of Ralph Lauren. So they're, you know,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so they're kind of, you know, they're a power couple. And so I shot a cover story, fashion story with her, and then got to shoot the whole family, and it was a fun story. But we shot it at at sunset in Montauk, like in front of their house and backlit and gorgeous and beautiful. And then like after the photos were in, like the editor of the magazine decides that they, oh, I think it should be a black and white story. I'm like, who does that? Who shoots like at sunset and changes it to black and white? And even if you did want to, like I would have, you have to expose things differently. Just like, it looked flat. And
so they ran it as black and white?
They ran it as black and white.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, I could have, you know, at the not end of the day, like yet. I could have flexed my muscles and I was like, you know, this is not the hill that I want to die on. But yeah, just it rubbed me the wrong way.
That's ridiculous, dude. I was going to ask you actually earlier, I went around it, but how's your experience been working for the surf world? You know, like when you have done projects in the surf world, how has that been versus music and entertainment? But it sounds like you have issues everywhere you work. You know, bosses are bosses.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing is it's not, at the end of the day, I think there's the upper 1% of the fashion world has like the clout and the ego to be able to, you know, say, this is my vision and this and, you know, and like pull. And at the end of the day, like people are paying me to take pictures.
Right.
Or if they are, if they're paying me to right. take pictures. To some degree, it's their fault. They got to kind of have some understanding of what I do, you know? So if they're hiring me for something completely outside my wheelhouse, then it's on them. But for the most part, it's like, all right, you know, I'll put my 2 cents worth in. But at the end of the day, if you're paying for it, you know, yeah, it has my name on it. But, you know, you got to be flexible. And I've never been that guy that's been like, I'm an artist. This has to be, you know, you can kind of read people when they offer you the job, whether they're going to be a pain in the ass. And I turn down stuff sometimes just because I was like, this sounds like a nightmare. I don't think I'm the right person for this.
Right.
You know, like,
right. I asked you earlier kind of what's the business model look like? And then you just mentioned that photo shoot that you did. How much of it is photo features for magazines versus, do you shoot product at all? Is it all lifestyles?
Mostly, I would say a combination of lifestyles, editorial projects, and then I have a studio client that's been very good to me. I've been shooting for Macy's a lot, and that's like nuts and bolts in the studio, shooting stuff for e-commerce, and it's like, They're great, and they have like a no jerk policy. They're kind of like, listen, cool. If you don't want to do this, there's 30 people behind you that would love to do it. Times are tough, and so everybody on set is wonderful. The art director is like one of my best friends. She actually lives out in Rockaway, so I'm like actual friends with her. So we get to like hang out on set, work. I can walk to work and be home with my son at 4 o'clock. So good. Extremely fortunate to have like kind of a bread and butter job like that.
We talked a bit about this last time, but it's a new conversation now just because so much has changed in recent years. What's your view on Instagram or just using Instagram as a tool, I guess, because so many photographers have built their career on it and you seem to only post sparingly. I mean, maybe once a week at most, and you don't really seem to be using it as a tool to like build your brand. It's more just kind of like to showcase an occasional.
Yeah, I guess this is a combination of maybe a little bit of stubbornness, a little bit of laziness, a little bit of chagrin. Like I think it was a lot more optimistic about the Instagram revolution than I am today. I don't know, I think it's just, it's some people have really made it work for themselves. Like I went on this trip with a friend of mine last summer. We did this photo shoot in Norway, and there was a Fuji ambassador, I guess, that came with us. And he, you know, they had loaned him this really expensive camera. And I don't know what exactly his relationship with Fuji is, but he's like an Instagram quote unquote influencer and has, I don't know, 600,000 followers or whatever. And I looked at his work, and it's like, it's nice. It's correct. You know, it's in focus. It's beautiful. But it's just like, after the fourth one, I'm just like, I'm not inspired, you know? And it's just such a strange currency it seems really crass that you just click on someone's profile and you look at that one number with a K before it or K after it, and like that kind of defines their value. And I don't know, I think it'd be interesting to see how this plays out in the next couple of years, because I know the brands are, there was like a frenzy for a while for like these influencers and getting people, you know, to shoot these shoots that aren't necessarily amazing photographers, but they have this follower. But like, it's really, I think people are starting to really question the return on investment on these influencers, you know, like, do I really care that there's a 12-year-old in Prague that like sees this photo? Like, how, what is that valuable to a brand? I don't know. We'll see, you know?
Yeah. Is it because, I mean, maybe you're having that experience when you look at their work because it's on your phone and it's this small square that you're looking at, and it's not a great showcase of their work.
And it's a feed too. So like it's gone instantly. Right. And then, you know, I keep my following with the people that I follow, like relatively small, and my following is, you know, relatively small compared to a lot of people. But at the same time, like, it speaks to the people that I'm trying to reach with this project. Like, I'll post something and like Kelly Slater will see it, or Mick Fanning will see it, or you'll see it, you know, like people that I actually like want to speak to are seeing this. You know, and it's interesting too, because so that photo that I posted of Kim Porter and Puffy's kids, of she passed away, like, I must have made it to their main page or something, because I got like almost 8,000 likes on that, which is nowhere near anything that I would never ever normally get. And you know, I got like whatever, a bunch of new followers, but it's like, I don't think a bunch of like teenagers that follow Puffy are necessarily gonna care. Like, I'm interesting to see how long those followers stay on my feed, because that's not really, I don't speak to them, you know. And so it's an interesting time.
I guess what I would argue is there are more people out there who actually would value your work and want to see it than currently know you exist. And so how else can you get a hold of them? How else can you show your work to those people?
Yeah, and then part of me kind of feels like at this point, I mean, once I have the actual product of this, you know, the HI1K book to sell, then I'll have a different perspective. But on a Wednesday afternoon, like, I don't really care if like everybody in the world sees these photos. Like, you know, sure, it'd be nice, and I'm proud of them, and I like people to see it, but like, it's just this strange phenomenon of like what we talked about before with privacy. It used to be, remember when you're in junior high, there'd be girls who had a diary, and the diary had like a little like silly lock on the side, lest anybody ever like get a hold of it and read your most intimate thoughts. It's went from that to like the complete opposite, that if like, if you don't post your like coffee and your entree and your selfie every day and people don't respond to that, like, you don't exist. Like, it's I don't like that paradigm, you know. And I realize as a photographer that that's part of my job, and that that paradigm is just reality, and I have to play into that, but I don't love it. I really don't.
I agree with you, because I certainly don't post everything about my life. Like, I intentionally have portions of my life that never ever get posted, you know, but I still want to advocate for it for you and your business, you know, because like I said, it's great that you don't care if a million people ever see it, but I think that there are a million people who want to see it.
Yeah.
So it's almost like, do it for them. And that's, I think that Kim Porter example is a great one, because it validates it. It's like, oh, there were 8,000 people out there. They just weren't following you.
Yeah.
It had to go through a different channel for them to even see it, you know?
But, you know, at the end of the day, I guess that's what it comes back to. It's a great time for photography for someone who just wants to take pictures. There's an amateur, you know, a teenager with an iPhone. You really can document your life, or document your dog or your friends or whatever's important to you, and get it out there to the world. And that's never really been able to happen in civilization before,
right,
to this scale. However, like, I'm a professional photographer. Like, I put a roof over my family's head with paying bills, taking photos. And so having 100,000 followers is not necessarily like monetarily valuable. I'd rather have like 5 badass art directors that see my work than like a teenager in Brazil.
Right.
You know, but
yeah. Total side topic. What's that image on the wall behind the TV?
That is my friend Spencer Tunick, who is one of my oldest friends in New York. We used to live together in this storefront that I had in the East Village, and he's kind of made a name for himself. He is known for taking these large-scale nude installations all over the world, and we've done them. I've traveled all over the world with him. That one's actually taken at Burning Man. I wasn't there for that. He gave me that as our wedding gift. But I traveled to, we went to Mexico City. We did 19,000 naked people in the Zocalo in Mexico City. We did 5,000 people naked inside the Sydney Opera House. He was commissioned by Greenpeace to raise awareness for global climate change. We did an installation on a glacier in Switzerland with a couple hundred people. So
I've seen his work before.
Yeah, he's one of my oldest friends. He's a funny dude.
I didn't recognize his name, and maybe the reason why I've seen his work is you've posted about it years ago or something, because it's been a while since I've seen any of it.
Yeah, it's weird. He's kind of a, I mean, his business model, he definitely sells stuff you know, in the fine art world, he'll sell prints. But he's kind of a periphery player. Like, I'm not really in the quote-unquote art world at all. I'm a commercial artist, if you want to make that distinction. He's like a fine artist, but kind of as a periphery figure. But because of the nature of his work, like, every time that he does a shoot, there's, like, the world is aware of it for 24 hours, like, almost always, depending on which country and where we go, like, the AP will pick up on it. So it's on the wire services. So it's like, he's like blasted across the world for a day. And then people may or may not forget about it. But it's funny, if you mention his name, the brand recognition, maybe not so much. But if you follow it up with, oh, you know, he's the guy that does, and they're like, oh, I know that guy.
Exactly.
Like, it's 8 out of 10 people know who he is.
I was one of the 8. That just happened to me. What photographers do you admire?
For me personally, I kind of built this project on the inspiration of rock photography. You know, like people like Jim Marshall or even Bob Gruen. He took like amazing photos of the Sex Pistols and beautiful portraits of and pictures, intimate stuff of John Lennon and the stuff that you see. Like, I just love all that backstage photos from the 70s, like Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones. And, you know, I think what we talked about before, those pictures will kind of, they'll have a historical value to them because they tell a story, as opposed to, you know, a portrait kind of sometimes gets stale over the years because the lighting trends change or the styling of the clothes change and it's not necessarily telling a story. So I love people that kind of take pictures with a news historical value, like Magnum photographers. Like, I met a friend of mine just got brought in, he works for Life magazine, and I got to go to the Life archives in Jersey City. It's like this massive cold storage warehouse of like the entire Life archive. And it's basically like, it's run by this woman who's like in her 20s, who is like an art student, and like she has to just scramble to get budgets from the corporation to even like pay the bills to keep this. But like, it's so underutilized, and it's like this building essentially like the beating soul of American history essentially, and like it's so underutilized. And we went in and it was almost so overwhelming, like it would have been better if I did some research and said, okay, here's a topic and what do you have on it, because it's so exhaustive. But we just went into like a random like file cabinet and pulled out stuff. And what's so amazing is that each of those photographers, in addition to just the incredible talent and access and scope of everything they captured, they had to file like a photo brief with each of their projects. So not only is there this amazing photography, but there's like these really beautiful essays essentially, like describing what they went through and what these pictures are, and like it's amazing. I love stuff like that.
That is fascinating. Did you see that film that came out a year or two ago? I think it's called Life. It's about the photographer who traveled with James Dean, like on the last film shoot he did before he died.
Oh, amazing.
Robert Pattinson is the photographer or plays the photographer. It's really good.
Oh, it's a fiction, it's a movie.
Like it's a movie movie.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. No, I didn't see that.
Like a scripted movie, based on, you know, the actual events. Because I guess there was this Life photo series that came out on I think it might have come out after he passed away, but obviously they shot it all like in that final kind of couple of weeks. And so it's about their relationship as it develops while they're on the road together. And but it kind of is exactly what you just said, you know. It's really fascinating.
There's a new Peter Jackson documentary coming out. Have you seen that?
No.
He took essentially it's 100-year-old World War I footage that's all like black and white and destroyed and grainy, and colorized it. But I remember they did that, and Ted Turner did that in the 80s, and it looked horrible, and it was controversial. So this is like colorization 2.0, but yeah. Peter Jackson, his attention to historical accuracy is like renowned and, you know, legendary. So they took this old footage, and they actually sourced old costumes and old materials so that they could individually match like each of the color palettes. And then they added Foley sound to the cannons and like restored it. And like, I mean, it looks fantastic. And
I've seen ads for that on Instagram.
It
now that
amazing.
You say it,
yeah.
I just never really.
And it looks so humanizing too. Yeah. Cause I mean, that was such a just horrifically ugly war, but it's so easy to kind of look back and be like, those are black and white people from 100 years. Those aren't real people. Those are olden times. You know what I mean?
Like, even watching I Love Lucy, my brain cannot reconcile that their color was as vibrant as ours is here right now.
Yeah, their blood was red, not gray.
Exactly.
You know, like,
it's weird.
Yeah.
Your brain can't do it. It's weird. What is your ideal work schedule look like? As a photographer who's kind of always shifting, trying to adapt to the market needs and technology and all that, what does it look like?
I mean, I love the fact that still to this day, my favorite part of photography is just that every day is different. And, you know, like some people are always complaining, like when I am not working, I'm obsessed with checking my email. It's almost, it's like career roulette, you know, like you push it like, oh, that's not, there's two cherries and a bell, you know, like, oh, three cherries. But literally like most people like kind of loathe having to check their emails just because like, oh, I got to put out this fire or whatever. Whereas like if I'm not working, I don't really have any bad emails, but you know, it's unlikely or rare, but at any given point I could click send receive and get like a $10,000 email or whatever, you know. Yeah. So I love that aspect of it. And just the everyday is different. Like I just got back from this super random project. There's this artist named Ray Pruitt, who I wasn't really that familiar with, but he did this branded collaboration with this Italian fashion company, made a blanket, you know, like a branded blanket. And so they shot this little video of him, quote unquote, like he was moving to Canada, was the whole theme of it, of this video. So they hired me, we had this whole production, they put this chair in the back of a rented 77 pickup truck, covered it with this branded blanket, and we literally drove to Canada like last week and like filmed it. Like very random, but it was like, it was great. And like it's funny, ironically, I just flew back from Vancouver the night before having family Thanksgiving, and then woke up in the morning and drove to Canada, literally drove to the border, couldn't go through because they wouldn't let us film. I mean, we knew that ahead of time, but then literally like U-turned in front of like the crossing guard and then drove back to the States. But
that's so fun.
You know, it's just fun getting to do, every day is completely different. You know, I love that.
Yeah, that's fantastic. When you look back at this kind of 10 years of imagery on the North Shore, are there any moments that you missed? I mean, obviously, most of your memories are going to be attached to photos you've been looking at forever, but were there any moments that you just cringed having missed?
Not so much. There was a weird moment last year. I'd shot John John a lot over the years. I got to shoot him a lot for Nixon because I work with them, and he was on their team, and I shot him for a couple other brands. And then right, you know, after his first world title, I think his access really changed, not just for me, but for everybody. He just was like, he wasn't just that kid that walked up and down on the North Shore and people would like have, you know, high five. He was like the world champion, and he was definitely kind of sequestered a lot more. And so there was a couple moments where I felt like I would have normally had access to him, but I didn't, that I was just like, oh, I really want that. But I did some beg, borrowing, and stealing, and I think I got some pretty amazing shots in the end. But there was some ones that was one of the few times where I'm like, oh, really? I feel like I would have normally had that access, but the tides had shift. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, when I think about images I've seen of yours from the North Shore, it feels like you have access to almost everybody. I mean, from the Wolf Pack to Slater to John John and Julian Schnabel.
It's grown over the years. I mean, I definitely like to think, you know, I caught my stride a couple years in, but like each year, you know, I'd add like a new house to my repertoire. So like, you know, like literally my first year, like, which was, you know, back then was probably like the biggest lion's den of them all. But like my first kind of entree was to the Volcom House. Like Troy Eckert brought me over, introduced me to Kai, and was like, okay, here's blah, blah, blah. And so like I had access to that. But I mean, I still remember sitting like on the sand, looking up at like, you know, Jamie O'Brien's house, or looking up at Mick Fanning at the Rip Curl house, being like, oh, what goes on up there? But I mean, in a way it's a good thing. It speaks to me, in the same sense, I like to put myself in that 12-year-old's perspective of like, oh, what's my favorite rock star doing backstage? You know, it just made me that much more thirsty to figure out a way to like get into that house, you know?
Yeah.
And for the most part, I was able to. Largely with, I mean, I think one of my main tricks, not a trick, but every year I go over, I have a 5x7 box of like signed prints that I give to people that I shot the year before. And it adds a lot of incentive for me to be able to like walk up on someone's lawn. And so my first interaction when I see somebody that I hadn't seen for 12 months is me giving them something rather than me like asking them for something, you know? And so it's an image of themselves. And sometimes, you know, a lot of the people I know, and a lot of people, they may not necessarily know me or know that I took that picture, but I'll just go up and say, hey, you know what? I just wanted to say thanks. I brought this for you. And they're just like kind of blown away, you know, especially because there's 1,001 photographers over there, but everybody is like, oh, I got this amazing picture of you. And they show you like the back of their phone or their camera. And like no one ever really touches physical prints anymore. And so to be able to like say, hey, you know what? I know you're inviting me onto the lawn of your house and I'm a guest and here, I brought this for you, instead of like walking up and putting a camera in their face, you know? And, and I think it kind of speaks to the nature of like the Hawaiian culture over there. Like they're very warm people. They're full, you know, like the aloha spirit, but at the same time, like be respectful, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's my way of being respectful.
It's a great little method, but I could also imagine a lot of people don't know what you look like, because we've all seen images of Todd Glazer and Steve Sherman or whomever that have been interviewed by a bunch of different surf publications, but I can't think of any where I've seen images of you.
Yeah, I like to kind of keep behind the scenes. I mean, it's not that I'm secretive per se, but I mean, if you look at my Instagram, like I don't think there's a single picture of me. I definitely don't do the selfie thing, and it's just like, it's not about me, you know. Like I think that's just because I'm coming from a perspective of like, I mean, this is a business and this is my job and this is what I'm doing. You know, if you're a roadie for a band, you don't like trying to bum rush the stage during the concert, you know. It's like, stay in your lane. Like, I'm here, and at the end of the day, like I would much rather have an iconic shot, or at least, you know, whatever, something that means a lot to me than to like fan out and like go party with Kelly for the night.
Totally.
You know, and then it's a different perspective. A lot of people are maybe be the opposite, but at the end of the day, like, you know, I'll be like, oh, I hung out with Kelly and we got drunk. Like, yeah, whatever. I have pictures of him and, you know, Shane Dorian and his son, like, laughing. Like, that's more important to me.
Yeah. You know? It's more lasting, that's for sure. Yeah. In terms of access, is there anybody who you would love to get kind of quality time with?
That's a good question. I've been really fortunate. I think most of the people that are really have been extremely intrigued by, I've gotten to spend a lot of time with. Jordy's pretty elusive. It's funny, for as much presence and stature he has, you know, like in terms of surfing on the North Shore in the last 10 years, I probably have the least amount of photos in terms of marquee names of him. Not that he's that secretive. It's just like a lot of it's just a product of circumstance, you know? And I think when the book comes out, I'm going to make sure that that's really clear too, that this isn't like my definition of who's important on the North Shore. It's circumstantially, these are the people that I've had access to. Like, you know, thankfully, like, I think it's a pretty wide range, but there's definitely people that have kind of fallen through the cracks, you know.
Yeah, I can see Jordy circumstantially, like, he's probably the only guy on the CT who's on O'Neill, so it's not like there's a huge congregation in that community. And then South Africa is not a huge contingent either, so
I mean, I guess Gabe, I've actually kind of peripherally been able to shoot pictures of him, more so just because of my relationship with Mick Fanning. And so they stay in the same house. So Mick is just a warm, wonderful person. And so I kind of have access to the house because of that. And Gabe's kind of been in the background, and I'll do my old trick. Like I'll definitely bring some photos of Gabe, and, you know, I caught some pretty amazing photos of him and his family, like the year that he won the title. And so, you know, I have a little bit of a relationship, but he's pretty reclusive too. You know, I think that's a product of just his champion mindset, and also just like, I don't want to say antagonism, but he's not, maybe not the most popular person on the North Shore in terms of like just wanting to be up in the mix, you know.
Yeah.
He definitely keeps to himself.
So some of the most interesting, when I look at in terms of access and this whole conversation, when I look at it from the podcast sphere, I want the interviews with the periphery people. Like my kind of hit list would be John John's mom, like Mom John. You know, Kalani Miller, Kelly's girlfriend, Andy and Bruce's parents would be a phenomenal one. You know, like those people are kind of more interesting stories, because I mean, Kelly's been interviewed a million times.
For sure.
And John John's been interviewed a million times, but Mom John, her role is so important.
And it's funny you brought her up. Like, I have met her at least a dozen times. I've been in their house. I've been like, I'd like to think that she knows who I am, but like, she's definitely, you know. And I brought her photos too, like of her and John. I'm like, oh, I just want to say it. And she's just not very warm to me. And I don't know if that's just a matter of her personality. I mean, I part of me doesn't take any offense to it, just because I know that she just best, you know, like, she has had to create this, like, insular world to, I mean, she's raised amazing children, yeah. You know, I mean, and that's just undeniable. John John's just, like, there's so many opportunities for him to have, like, gone off the rail, and he never once had no scandal, no drugs. No, he's just, like, he's a good person. He's focused. And so, you know, kudos to her for that. And yeah. I think as a product, you have to kind of maybe create a certain environment around yourself. But yeah, it's funny you brought her up, because she's definitely, I don't have much of a relationship with her.
That's
it's
funny.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't expect her to be warm. I mean, I would expect her to be a good person and warm to her friends and all that sort of stuff. But as a surf photographer being there, I wouldn't expect her to be warm to you because of the things you just said.
Yeah.
It's like, dude, you're transient. Like, I have so many people coming by who want all of our attention.
And everybody wants something. And it's like, don't worry, I don't want anything from you. But she doesn't know that. Yeah.
No, exactly. Interesting.
But, you know, ironically, same thing with, like, Lindy on the flip side. Like, she is so warm.
And really?
Like, always invite me up. And, like, and on her, she's with Pat from Ruka now. Like, he's great. They're very, very gracious. And I was like, oh, come on, can I get you a drink? And, like, they've always been incredibly warm. So.
Yeah. What's your current relationship like with surfing? You obviously, especially when you're in Hawaii, do you even bring a board?
I mean, definitely don't bring a board, at least for the last couple of years, just because it's just like I'm traveling alone and the expense of it and the hassle of it.
That's
and it's
happening.
Like, I think honestly, I'm going to take some time for myself to actually surf this year, because usually what happens when I always intend to do that, and then it's just like either it's flat and garbage and there's nobody around and there's no pictures anyway, and I'm just like, oh, when's this gonna go down? Or it's like, I'll be like, okay, tomorrow's my day, and then I'll wake up and it'll be like 12 feet. I'm like, I'm not gonna that's above my pay grade, you know. Or the third element is that, like, it's a beautiful, fun little, like, kind of rippable day, like, for my skill level, but I'm just in the back of my mind, I always like, dude, am I missing a shot? Like, what's John John doing today? If he's not, you know, it's small, he's not surfing, what's he doing, you know? So it's hard.
If you're there for work, just work.
And it's you know, it's like, especially this year in particular, like, it's just like, I don't have that much going on. I'm really just going to kind of, you know, put a bow on this project and see what the next chapter is. So it's like, it's expensive, you know, so I want to, like, try and make something of it, you know.
What's your relationship like with surfing here at home?
This has been a tough season for me, just because, like, I have a son, he's turning 3, you know, in a couple of weeks, and it's just really hard. Rockaway is, I liken being a surfer in Rockaway of, like, being a fan of a really shitty sports team. You know, it's just like, you're always like, oh, come on, I love you, but seriously, you know. And, like, in the summertime, it's rarely that good unless there's, like, a proper early hurricane swell in August, you know. Like, and the problem is that the forecasting is really bad on the East Coast, in terms of, like, you could tell what the forecast is. It's always like, oh, you know, 2 to 4 feet at 5 seconds with light on shores, and it's like, at any time of the day it might be okay, and most of the times of the day it's crappy. And in order to really, like, get those windows, you have to, like, live in Rockaway. And, like, I have a bungalow out there, and, like, a lot of my close friends live there full time, but it's like, it's hard to do strike missions.
Yeah.
And you have this, like, evil Venn diagram of, like, work and my son's schedule and my wife's schedule and tides and winds, and it's really difficult, you know. So
do you miss surfing? And
I do. I feel like I'm on the verge of falling out of love with it.
Really?
Just because I haven't been in the water since, like, October, and it's just like, I'm looking forward to just even, like, being in Hawaii, even if I don't surf, just, like, sitting at Rocky Point and putting my feet in the water and just being a part of that environment is what I think at the end of the day drew everyone to surf for the first time. Because before you were a surfer, you still put your foot in the water and, like, wanted to be a part of the ocean, you know, I think.
You know?
So, yeah, I definitely am really looking forward to getting some time, because it's been a tough fall. I haven't gotten to be in the water much.
Yeah, I struggle with everything that you're talking about, and, like, and then I talk to people who are very actualized about it and can kind of let it empower them, and they haven't surfed for a long time, maybe because of an injury or whatever, but it's like, it still fuels their life, and they have this kind of light at the end of the tunnel that they're looking for, and because of that, they're tightening up their diet or whatever, and it's like they're living a better life knowing that surfing is down the pike. And then other people who, they haven't surfed in a week, and they're miserable for the entire week that they didn't surf, you know, they're the opposite end of the spectrum. So you and I both have real life obligations, and so I try not to let those things diminish my joy of surfing. And try to just look forward to surfing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm jealous in some way. Like, my wife is, you know, she does yoga and she does a lot of Pilates, and both of those activities are 2 blocks from the house, and they're predetermined by a schedule, and it's very easy if you want to make it a priority to make that a priority. You know, she can dip out and, like, do an hour class and be back in an hour and 10 minutes, you know, whereas, like, I don't know, I like trying to surf here. It's like, imagine if you're, you know, like, you loved bowling, for instance, and you showed up to the bowling lane, you took time off of your work, you go with your, and you get there, they're like, oh, sorry, the lanes are closed. Like, what? When are they opening? I don't know. Maybe next week. Yeah. You know, it's like, it's hard, man.
Yeah, it is. It is, but that's the joy in it too, you know?
It is. I mean, I think that kind of speaks to, I mean, you guys have talked about it ad nauseum, like the whole surf park thing versus like surfing in the ocean. But it's like, I mean, I guess the way that I characterize it is like surfing in the ocean is like, you know, you go out, you put on like a cool outfit and you go to a party and like, oh, maybe there'll be a girl. Oh, that girl's cute. I'll go talk to her. And like, oh, maybe she's, oh, I made her laugh. Well, I got her number. Oh, we're going to go out for a date. And oh, you know, the date's going good. Oh, I'm going to kiss her. And then like, and then you end up like spending the night and sleeping with her, you know, like that's surfing. And then a wave park is like getting a hand job from a hot stripper, you know? It's just like, it basically cuts to everything that you really, really want in the end, but somehow it just diminishes it. And, you know, like, yeah, I don't know. It's strange.
It's a different version of an email I got from drummer Dave. I don't know if you remember. I read it to Chaz on air one time. It was like, said essentially the same thing, which was, I'd rather like work hard to earn a six at the bar, like go to the bar and find a six and like pick her up and take her home and like and hit a home run, then pay for a 10 at the strip, at, you know, the whorehouse.
It's funny, but on the same token though, I think a lot of people, you know, you romanticize the notion of going on a surf trip. If you've ever been skunked, you know, like in retrospect, it might be like, oh, you know, it's about the journey, not the destination. And we laughed and we had a good time. Like, yeah, that's great. In looking back upon it, but like while it's happening, you're like, sucks, dude. You took money off of maybe you have a finite amount of like time or money, and you're like, yeah, it sucks. So on that hand, you know, the stripper hand job might come handy, you know.
They all serve a purpose. Why can't you have both, huh?
Yeah, I think I think ultimately you can. I think they're gonna learn, they're gonna coincide by each other, you know, next to each other. In terms of a viewer experience, that might be a different thing. But
yeah, completely. Do you ever see yourself living outside of New York?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's funny. The gravitational pull for me has been back to California for a long time. I think, you know, like I moved to Manhattan, and it's funny, now Brooklyn is like a whole thing. People come to New York and go just to Brooklyn or whatever, but 10, 15, whatever, how many years ago, like, I was super snotty. I was like, I'm not going to live in Brooklyn. I moved from California to live in Brooklyn. No way, Manhattan, you know? And so Manhattan just holds like such a dear, special place in my heart. But, you know, the East Coast as a whole, I don't really like have much attachment to it, you know, like we were talking before, like I haven't traveled that much on the East Coast. Like I did, my heart's still in California, and more importantly, like my family's still out there, and my wife's family's in Vancouver on the West Coast. So I mean, I definitely feel that pull towards it, but at the same time, in terms of being able to raise a kid in New York City, like we're pretty dialed. Like I'm just so fortunate to have, you know, this amount of space for New York City and like an Empire State View. And like my son's school is a block away and he has friends in the building and we have a private park in the back. And so in terms of like New York living, like it'd be hard to top this even in California, you know? So I think eventually, I think once he's in like school, we might have to make some tough decisions, but for now, just, I guess, try and make it out there to visit as much as possible.
Yeah, it's tough. I'm spending all this time on the East Coast. It's opened my eyes to all the different ways there are to live, and there's a lot of good options, man. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's a good thing, is there's a lot of good options. They're not all bad. But it makes you feel a lot of pressure when you're trying to commit to that next phase, whether it's buying property or raising kids or whatever.
Yeah.
Because it's like, dude, some of these small towns in North Carolina are freaking amazing, and you have a ton of land and everybody gets to stay and play outside, and you have beautiful seasons every season, and there's great food, and it's inexpensive.
It's true. I mean, I feel like I had zero roots or any reason to stay, and I've been here for 20 plus years, but ironically I feel like it was a lot less intimidating moving to New York City as like a dumb 18-year-old than like moving out of New York City as like a grown man, you know. Like I have spoons and furniture and stuff. You know, I mean, like, mm-hmm. I have, like, things. Like, just the logistics of moving across the nation. Like, that alone is just seems ominous. So
I feel like there's a couple places, too, that would be super hard to move back into. Like, if you left Manhattan and sold your place, how would you ever get back into Manhattan?
I think that's part of that paradigm too. Is like, once I leave, I'm not going to move back to New York when I'm 50. Right. You know, like, it's like, once I leave, it's like, that's, I love you, doors closed. You know,
so that's hard.
It's hard.
That's a tough decision to make. You know, final question for everybody is just, what was the last surfboard that you rode? I know it was October.
I just had a, I had a new board shaped. Was basically came a little late. You know, shapers are. It would have been a good summer board, but it was just like a 7.2. It's called an experience. So no, this is just going out to use Chaz.
Perfect.
Get on the egg, Chaz. Get on the egg, dude.
Seriously.
It's like a pole tailed egg, single fin, 7.2, like super fun. There's just really a pretty amazing shaper. Kind of came out of nowhere and just like really took over in Rockaway. Paul Schmidt, he goes by Paul Surf, makes beautiful boards, and more than anything, he shapes and glasses himself, which is incredibly rare. He's like a great craftsman. So it just got like a Volan deck on the top and like cool pinstripe that I designed on the bottom, like just simple summer board,
dude. Totally coincidentally, or maybe not, but he just followed me on Instagram this morning.
Oh, no way.
So, yeah, and I've seen his work in the past and stuff, but that's so funny. I think it's because the guys at Swell Season tagged me in something, and I'm sure he knows them or follows them.
Yeah, it's pretty, it's funny, too, because I feel like most shapers kind of have their lane of what they focus on. Like, his boards, it's kind of all over the place. There's a lot of longboards just because it speaks to the waves in Rockaway. Right. But, I mean, he makes, like, fun little fishes, and he surfs. He's super stylish. He surfs really well, so that helps.
That definitely helps. Right on, Justin J.
All right.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
HI1K.com is the website where you can pre-order the book. Obviously, I'm a huge fan of Justin's work and eager to get my hands on this. I saw the PDF version and the art direction is stunning and amazing. So I've pre-ordered mine, and again, that pre-order process is actually highly important for the publisher. So don't put it off and assume that you'll be able to buy it during the holidays or whatever. Just pre-order now. That helps them predict costs. It keeps waste low, so it's just a better way to run the business as a whole. I've pre-ordered 3 with the intention of gifting 2 during the holidays. So hi1k.com is the website. Follow Justin on Instagram at JustinJPhoto, and I've posted his previous episode on Surf Splendor in your show notes. Me being in New York to record this episode was partially due to Spy's support of this podcast, spyoptic.com, for your sunglasses or snow goggle needs. They do prescription lenses as well. And when you use our promo code podcast in the month of June, you'll get a free t-shirt, Surf Splendor sunglass pouch, and a year-long membership to the Surf Rider Foundation. I'll process all of those memberships at the end of June and then just send you an email confirmation. So spyoptic.com, promo code podcast. By the way, make sure you add the t-shirt to your cart, and then the promo code podcast will cancel out the cost. So thank you for your ongoing support. This is David Scales for Surf Splendor, reminding you to get back into the ocean, share some waves, and shred on.